Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network.
In the future, none of you are heroes.
You're legends.
Get driven. Stay driven.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Bear Backpacks, and today I've got something special for all of you. Today, we're going to be crossing some lines. We're going to be walking that fine line between good and evil, between light and darkness, as we journey into the legend of Kaer Thornak and her relationship with the famous patron saint of Ireland, himself, Saint Patrick. Now, for a little bit of background, I'd like to start first off by talking specifically about Saint Patrick for those of you unfamiliar with him. Saint Patrick, yes, the Saint Patrick of Saint Patrick's Day, was a 5th century Romano-British Christian missionary and bishop in Ireland, gone by a number of names. Number one, he was known as the Apostle of Ireland. And he is the primary patron saint of Ireland, along with the saints Bridget of Kildare and Columba. He is also venerated in the Anglican community, the Old Catholic Church, and in the Eastern Orthodox Church, as equal to the apostles and as enlightener of Ireland. So he's kind of a big deal, in case you didn't know. Now, according to the Confessio of Patrick, when he had a pretty interesting life. Now, the dates of his life cannot be fixed with any certainty, but there is a broad agreement that he was an active missionary in Ireland during the second half of the 5th century. Early medieval tradition credits him with being the first bishop of Armagh and primate of Ireland, and they regard him as the founder of Christianity in Ireland, converting a society practicing a form of Celtic polytheism that can be traced all the way back to the time in which the roaming Celtic tribes were still running around mainland Europe, quite a long ways back. He has been generally regarded ever since as the founder of Christianity in Ireland, despite evidence of some earlier Christian presence in Ireland. Now, according to the Confessio of Patrick, when he was about 16, he was captured by Irish pirates from his home in Britain and taken as a slave to Ireland. Looking after animals, he lived there for 6 years before escaping and returning to his family. After becoming a cleric, he returned to Northern and Western Ireland, and later in life he served as a bishop, but little is known about the places where he worked. Now, by the 7th century, he had already come to be revered as the patron saint of Ireland for his many supposed miracle workings, and St. Patrick's Day is now observed on March 17th, the supposed date of his death. It is celebrated inside and outside Ireland as a religious and, of course, cultural holiday. In the Diocese of Ireland, it is both a solemnity and a holy day of obligation. It's also a celebration of Ireland itself. Only name that Patrick uses for himself in his writings is Patricus or Patricius, which gives old Irish Patriac and modern Irish Padraig. Of course, we have English, an English representation of that is Patrick. Now, two Latin works survive, which are generally accepted as having been written by him himself. They are called the Declaration, or in Latin, the Confessio, and the Letter to the Soldiers of Coruticus, or the Epistola, from which come the only generally accepted details of his life. The Declaration is the more biographical of the two, and in this, which, and of course it would be because it's in Latin, it is the Confessio, which means the confession. So it is Patrick's confession of his life, his account, if you will, of his life. Now, Patrick, in it, gives a short account of his life and his mission, his goals, what he is supposed to be doing. And most available details of his life are from subsequent hagiographies and annals, which have considerable value but lack the imprint on today. And what that means is most of what we have are hagiographies, and hagiographies are saint lives. For those of you unfamiliar with the saints in the Catholic Church, the monks of the Catholic Church throughout the Middle Ages spent a good deal of time writing about the saints. They tell us what the saints did, why they're saints, what the reason we should revere them is, and oftentimes they're heavily embellished, but the value in them is that these people were, to the church, worth writing about, their legacy was worth preserving, and the, you know, while we can't, you know, necessarily take everything that they say at face value, obviously it's a little bit difficult for us to take every single thing they say about the miracles these people supposedly worked at face value. It does prove that these people either existed or were people, or are based off of people they thought were worth writing about. At the very least, they're decent stories that tell us what is important to the church at the time that they're writing and what they're trying to accomplish with the stories. They're trying to accomplish with these hagiographies is not only are they trying to they're trying to immortalize these people and memorialize these people for the things that they do, but they're also trying to get people to revere these individuals. They are trying to get people on the church train. How do you do that? Well, they know that the non-Christian communities have been telling stories for a very long time, and these stories are passed down from generation to generation. They're often very entertaining. They often have very colorful characters. So what better way to get people to start coming to church than to tell a very colorful story about a person who works for the church and becomes a very revered individual within the community, a.k.a. a saint. In essence, saints become an easier way communities to sort of leave paganism and come to the church. They're like, you know, they basically come around and they say, check out St. Patrick. He's a boss. Look at him throwing serpents off mountains and walking on oceans and fighting with the Loch Ness Monster. You want to hang out with him, or do you want to hang out with that boring god that you've been worshiping for the last 100 years? I think you want to hang out with St. Patrick. Look at him. He's drinking green beer and wrestling. He's wrestling Loch Ness Monsters. That's the guy. That's the guy you want to hang out with, but you can only hang out with him if you come to church. Honestly, I think I could have sold that saint better than they did, but I digress. Now, again, as we refer, we'll get back on track here. Patrick himself, usually refers to himself as Patricius. Now, hagiography records record other names that he is said to have borne. Tirichin's 7th century Collectania gives Magnus, that is famous, Susitus, that is the god of war, Patricius, that is father of the citizens, Cothariacus, because he served 4 houses of Druids, Magonus appears in the 9th century in the Historia Britonum as Maun and descending from British Magonus, which means servant lad, Succetus, which also appears in the 7th century life as Soche, and is identified as Macneil as a word of British origin meaning swineherd. But again, this is a guy that's got a number of names. And again, as I said, Patrick's life, the dates of his life are uncertain. There are a lot of conflicting traditions regarding the year of his death, and his own writings provide no evidence for any dating more precise than the 5th century generally. So since his writings are generally dated to around the 5th century, his biblical quotations are a mixture of the old Latin version and the Vulgate Bible, which was completed in the early 5th century. And this suggests to us that he was writing at the transition from Old Latin to Vulgate, So it's possible that Vulgate readings may have been added later, replacing earlier readings. The letter to Coroticus implies that the Franks were still pagans at the time of his writing. Their conversion to Christianity is dated to the period between 496 and 508. The Irish annals for the 5th century date Patrick's arrival in Ireland at 432, but they were compiled in the mid-6th century at the earliest. The date 432 was probably chosen to minimize the contribution of Palladius, who was known to have been sent to Ireland in 431, and maximize those efforts of Patrick. Now, there's a variety of dates that are given for his death. They say in 457, the elder Patrick is said to have died. This may refer to the death of Palladius, who, according to the Book of Armagh, was also called Patrick. In 461 and going into 462, the annals say that here some record the repose of Patrick. In 492, they record the death of Patrick, the archapostle or archbishop of the Scoti, on March 17th, age of 120. So that with a grain, take that with a grain of salt. So while some modern historians accept the earlier date of circa 460 for Patrick's death, scholars of early history, Irish history, tend to prefer a later date, probably circa 493. Supporting the later date, the annals record that in 553, the relics of Patrick were placed 60 years after his death in a shrine by Columcille. The death of Patrick's disciple Mokta is dated in the annals to 535 or 537, and early hagiographies all bring Patrick into contact with persons whose obits occur at the end of the 5th century or the beginning of the 6th. One historian, E.A. Thompson, however, argues that none of the dates given for his death in the annals are reliable. Though some historians believe that there are multiple Patricks, that's what fusion is. But, you know, whatever. Nonetheless, here's why St. Patrick is relevant to what we're talking about today and why he's important. Early stories of St. Patrick have St. Patrick arriving in Ireland and working a number of miracles. Let's look at some of the legends surrounding St. Patrick, shall we? Legend credits St. Patrick with teaching the Irish about the doctrine of the Holy Trinity by showing people the shamrock, a three-leaf plant, using it to illustrate the Christian teaching of three persons in one God. This story first appears in writing in 1726, though it's up for debate how old it is. The shamrock has since become a central symbol for St. Patrick's Day. And, of course, good luck back, good luck to find a shamrock, apparently. Now, in pagan Ireland, three was a significant number, and the Irish had many triple deities. Number one and probably chief among them was the Morrigan, who was perhaps one of the most critical deities within Celtic mythology and Celtic beliefs. She was a messenger of war, and she was the primary goddess of the afterlife. So, and a number of other things. But this is probably a fact that likely aided St. Patrick in his evangelizing efforts when he held up a shamrock and discoursed on the Christian Trinity. Now, there's no evidence, according to some historians, such as Patricia Monaghan, that the shamrock was sacred to the pagan Irish, though some speculate that it may have represented the regenerative powers of nature and was recast in a Christian context. Icons of St. Patrick often depict the saint with a cross in one hand and a sprig of shamrocks in the other. But it's likely that while it might not have been particularly relevant, the shamrock itself might not have been particularly relevant to pagans, they probably would have been able to figure out what Patrick was going for. Now, one of the most famous, perhaps the most famous story about St. Patrick
is that he banished all snakes from Ireland when he arrived. There's this huge story about St. Patrick. When he arrived, just casting out all the snakes in Ireland. And there's supposedly that is the reason why there's no snakes in Ireland. Now, the absence of snakes in Ireland gave rise to the legend that upon the arrival of St. Patrick, St. Patrick strode up to a big hill. After they chased him, he strode up to a big old hill and cast them out after they attacked him during a 40-day fast that he was undertaking atop the hill. After they attacked St. Patrick, you know, homie, don't play that. He told him to get the heck out of there. And all the snakes supposedly decided to beat a hasty retreat to the ocean. Now, this theme draws on the biblical account of the staff of the prophet Moses in the book of Exodus, chapter 7. Chapter 7 and 8, I believe. Moses and Aaron used their staffs in their struggle with the Pharaoh's sorcerers, the staffs of each side morphing into snakes. Aaron's snake staff prevails by eating the other snakes. You want to talk about a measuring contest there. We'll leave that innuendo for later. Suggests, however, that post-glacial Ireland never actually had snakes. At no time has there ever been any suggestion of snakes in Ireland. There's nothing written on it. So, nothing for St. Patrick to banish, according to biologists and naturalists. Nigel Monaghan, keeper of natural history at the National Museum of Ireland, Dublin. Evidence of snakes in Ireland, suggesting that St. Patrick casting out snakes is just a load of bull, because there was never any for him to cast out. Still a pretty cool story. But here's some of the other couple of other legends associated with them. We'll get to the next one here, and then we'll talk about his relationship to this other, to the major figure of today's show, and that's K.R. Thornack. So other legends have Patrick's walking stick growing into a living tree, but century work called the Acalum Nesa Senorak. And it tells of Patrick being met by two ancient warriors, Tiat Mac Ronan and Oisin, during his evangelical travels. These two were once members of Fionn Mac Cumhail's warrior band, the Fianna. Now, if you're not familiar with who the Fianna are, they are famous Irish heroes, and they feature prominently in the Fenian cycle. Now, these are Irish epics. Supposedly, St. Patrick talked to these guys. And somehow, these guys were around when Patrick arrived in the work. St. Patrick seeks to convert them to Christianity while they defend their pagan path. The heroic pagan lifestyle of the warriors of fighting and feasting and living close to nature is contrasted with the more peaceful but unheroic and non-sensual life offered by Christianity. This book, the Acalum Nesa Senorak, is translated to English as the Colloquy of the Ancients, Tales of the Elders. It's declared by some to be the most important text of the Fenian cycle, and at about 8,000 lines, it's the longest surviving work of original medieval Irish literature. Now, it contains a number of Fenian narratives framed by a story in which the Fianna warriors have survived long enough to relate the tales of their lives and the great deeds that they accomplished to St. Patrick, at which point St. Patrick says, you know, basically, well, that's all fine and dandy, but it's time for you guys to realize I represent the true God and you guys need to convert. And it's a little back and forth between them and him. They regale Patrick with tales of Finn McCool and his men explaining place names they encounter in the manner of another Irish work. The stories reiterate the greatness of Finn and his departed Age of Heroes, often focusing on the rivalry between his family and that of his enemy, the Gold Mac Morna, which threatened the stability of the island. Other stories record the Fianna's relationship with the Otherworld and the Tuatha De Nann, who are the old gods of Ireland. While those involving Patrick often stress the importance of integrating the values and culture of pre-Christian Ireland with the new ways of the church, some of the individual tales likely predate their inclusion in this work, though the authors adapted them with an eye towards the narrative unity. And lastly, along with all the snakes, St. Patrick was said to have cast out every single demon and ancient god in Ireland, with the exception of one. Upon his arrival in Ireland, it is said that St. Patrick stood upon a hill and cast out all the ancient evils that lie in the land of Ireland. Everything from serpents, demons, monsters, and there are a great number of those in Irish mythology. For those of you who have stuck with my show long enough, you were around long enough to hear about the mighty Dullahan, or the source of the headless horseman, the Banshee. There are a number of terrifying entities within Irish folk lore and mythology. It's a rich culture full of rich storytelling. And St. Patrick was the guy who was going to come in and fix it all and just get rid of all these spooky things, including the Sluag and all these other terrifying things. Well, guess what? Now we've reached the point where he reaches out and touches the one entity that he couldn't cast out. She has a number of names. She's referred to as Cair Thonach, Cuir Honach, the Celtic Fire Spitter, the Mother of Demons, and Satan's Mother. The Great Demon Queen, Cair Thonach. The only entity that St. Patrick couldn't cast out, even with the light of the Christian Lord. Now, to get into who Cair Thonach is, it's important that we go back quite a ways. Before we do that, before we get directly into Cair Thonach and what's so terrifying about her, and perhaps why St. Patrick was unable to cast her out, according to legend, we're going to have to take a commercial break, because it's about that time. Hey guys, before we take commercial break, before we do that, I'd like to introduce one of our brand new sponsor. We have a proud new sponsor of Totally Driven Entertainment. He's funny, he's wacky, and he's crazy. He's also totally driven. Guys, you're going to want to check out ChrisBraleyPresents.com for all the latest in comedy. Guy's pretty funny. You guys want to check that out. We're going to go to commercial break, but when we come back, we're going to get into the old stories of Cair Thonach, and we're going to try to reconcile them with St. Patrick, and we're going to try to decipher why it is that St. Patrick couldn't seem to get rid of it. Why couldn't writers find it in themselves to give St. Patrick dominion and victory over every entity of evil that existed, or what they perceived to be evil? Because remember, for the Christians, the pagan ideologies were dangerous. They offered a different avenue, a different narrative, one that didn't lead to the salvation that they were selling. And Cair Thonach represents this old guard, this past that was supposed to die with the arrival of Christianity. It was time
with the arrival of Christianity into Ireland and the great stories they were telling about St. Patrick, it's clear that the church wanted to do away with all these stories. It was time for people to look away from those, forget about all that, and start embracing Christianity. But what was it about K.R. Zonack that they wouldn't let go? We're going to talk about that, how she becomes sort of an anchor between the world of Christian Ireland and the ancient past. So we'll talk about that when we come back from break.
I'm black man, saving mankind, one stereotype at a time.
To the black, my beer. To the corner of Martin Luther King Street and Malcolm X Boulevard, pronto.
Will black man make it to the crime on time? Or will he be on CPT? Stay tuned at ChrisFraleyPresents.com.
Attention business owners, website owners, event promoters, or anyone looking to promote your product. The Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network is the perfect way to spread the word of your business around the world. That's right, you can advertise at our network and be played on all of our shows at rates that are so cheap, it's a no-brainer. For more information, contact Bay Ragney at bayragney@gmail.com. To keep your business driven, stay driven with Totally Driven Entertainment.
Are you a fan of Sherlock Holmes? Letters from Holmes offers unique, one-of-a-kind letters from the world-famous detective himself. Handwritten on 8.5-inch by 11-inch aged parchment paper and using smudge-free ink to produce original, high-quality letters that fans will treasure for years to come. Each letter is handcrafted and written from the perspective of Sherlock Holmes, mimicking Holmes's native tongue and embracing many of the famous detective's quirks, quips, insults, and peculiarities. Order a love letter, birthday greeting, personal correspondence, or more only at www.etsy.com/shop/lettersfromholmes.
For $5 today, you can buy a wealth of things. Gas for your car, rent a movie for the family, a few slices of pizza. $5 still takes you a long ways. But did you know that $5 can buy your child a bag of heroin in the streets? That's right. For only $5, your son or daughter can buy some of the cheapest and purest dope in the country. Be aware of the lies. Be aware of the stealing. Be aware that's all it takes to kill your child. $5. This message was brought to you by Casey's Cause, a group of parents located in Southern Chester County out to save your child's life. Come join us today at www.caseyscause.com. And remember, $5 is all it takes. Casey's Cause, www.caseyscause.com.
Looking for that perfect gift for your girlfriend? Then look no further than Teddy Scares. Teddy Scares are available in a variety of styles, sizes, and prices for all your shopping needs. Teddy Scares are a mix of cute and creepy to make a great gift for almost any age. Board up your windows, lock your doors, and log on to TeddyScares.com. And be sure to become our friends at Facebook.com/TeddyScares.
Calling all comic book fans. Do you collect comics? Did you ever collect comics? Do you think your children might like reading comic books? Do you even know they still print real, paper, non-digital comic books? Well, then visit the Pirates of Ontario Street Comics in Philadelphia. We have a massive collection of comic books, action figures, trading cards, and much more. We have one of the largest stocks of back-issue comics in the area. We bag and board every new comic book at no extra charge. Our store is voted the best comic book shop in the 2013 PHL 17 Hot List Contest. Part of the movie Unbreakable is filmed in our store. We are open 7 days a week. Ontario Street Comics is located at 2235 East Ontario Street in the Port Richmond section of Philly. Our phone number is 215-288-7338. Type in the words Ontario Comics Philadelphia to check out our wacky stores page on Facebook.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to the show. I hope you guys enjoyed the little break from my voice because I am back. And there is no turning back now. We are in. We are in it to win it. We're staying with it. So we talked about St. Patrick's legend and why he's significant, at least within the context of Christian history in Ireland. Now we're going to talk about K.R. Zonack. Now, when the world was young and just a swirling mass of vapors, waters, rock, and stone, and
Raw Element Kaer Thonak was said to have hatched deep inside the molten core of the Earth itself. And there she waited, waiting, after all, to be the mother of all demons. According to legend, Kaer Thonak waited near the core of the Earth for humans to be born into the land. Why would she be waiting for humans? Well, according to legend, Kaer Thonak waited at the core of the Earth while giving birth to a vast, vast army of demon spawn. And these demon spawn had one thing on their mind, and that was to devour children, and humans in particular. In particular, her eldest son was said to be particularly voracious and had a particular proclivity for eating human beings. Kaer Thonak and her family waited throughout the ages, breeding and growing in number for the arrival of human beings. Comes into the 5th century. I get a picture. It's Ireland had recently emerged from the quote-unquote Dark Age, and then medieval life, and I hate Dark Ages, by the way, because it suggests that for some odd reason there was no light during this time period, which is a total load. It's a silly way of saying they were backward back then, but that's what people are going to say about us in a couple hundred years, so keep that in mind, everybody. But during the Middle Ages in Ireland, coming out of the early Middle Ages, life was still pretty hard, still pretty difficult for people. Life is tough, guys. It's just tough all over. The scattered and unruly tribes of the time were prisoner to hunger and disease, but also fear, a fear that came from a veritable onslaught of myths and magical beings that they saw behind every corner, in every shadow, and from every sudden illness and death that occurred. Now, by this point, Kaer Thonak and her demon children had supposedly run rampant, unchecked for thousands of years over the defenseless people of Ireland, and in short, the people had gotten pretty tired dealing with it, got pretty sick and tired of dealing with demons and monsters. Now, into this time period of magic, fairies, and monsters and demons, it is said during this time that Kaer Thonak and her demonic and hungry children were basically taking their pick of humankind and striking them dead whenever it struck their fancy. Kaer Thonak herself was said to, you know, cause settlements to burn down, the spread of disease, and her dreaded son is going to factor in even more as we go forward. Now, into this wild, chaotic time, and there's a man who went on to change the face of history. And there's a man who was going to get a very great publicist when he died, and that man is known as Patricius or St. Patrick, a man whose life is heavily debated. But nonetheless, as lives go, Patrick had a tumultuous first 50 years. The son of Roman nobility occupying Wales, he was captured by Irish pirates at the age of 16, sold as a slave. And he tended sheep for a druid priest master, received visions from God that instructed him to save Ireland from paganism, supposedly by converting the nation to Christianity. After 6 years of slavery, he escaped to France, studied the priesthood, was consecrated by Pope St. Celestine I as Bishop of the Irish, and sent back to Ireland to fulfill his vision and his mission of saving the Irish people. And save them he did from countless demons and curses and monsters of every shape and size that tried to break the spirit of his people and thwart his good work. Now, never mind the fact that he wasn't even Irish, but we won't get into that. Now, after his return to Ireland, Patrick had spoke out against the many demonic beings that supposedly exist within Ireland, many of whom had supposedly taken the form of snakes. Patrick prayed for guidance and aid in ridding his beloved Erin Isle of her and her ilk, and it was then that Jesus himself was said to have come to Patrick, telling him of a certain cave in the depths of Ludaird on Station Island, which was not only the Carathonax home, but a portal to hell itself. Yes, that's right. Supposedly, the portal to hell itself exists in Ireland, and Patrick found it. Now, according to legend, if Patrick could destroy Carathonax, he could rid his people of her pestilence and rid the whole of Ireland of all demonic forces forever. Of course, knowing what he had to do and being the awesome St. Patrick that he was, he climbed a steep slope to the top of the peak of Ox Mountain, now a place known as Quorog Patrick in the county of Mayo, on the coast of the dark Atlantic Ocean. There he raised his holy cross, and summoning all the grace and power God could grant him, banished all the snakes out of Ireland. They were caught in a tremendous whirlwind from Dublin to Galway and from the Atrium to Cork, which swept them all out to sea to sink into the murky depths, never to return. But according to legend, Carathonax put up much more of a fight than that. While she was caught in the same maelstrom that supposedly grabbed the other demonic forces in battle between good and evil, she didn't fall in the ocean. Instead, she fell to the ground on top of the very peak upon which Patrick stood. And supposedly, according to legend, they battled atop the mountain for 2 full days and nights in a very physical confrontation. Come on, Patrick, you're not supposed to hit girls, but apparently Patrick didn't care. They battled atop the mountain for 2 days and 2 full nights, finally fearing that Carathonax, finally fearing that she might be defeated, slid down the side of the cliff and made for the safety of Ludaird, with Patrick having grabbed a horse and hot on her heels. As she retreated, Carathonax knew the chase would make Patrick thirsty, so she made sure to spit toxic fire into every well and stream that they happened to pass, poisoning the water so that Patrick would have nothing to drink. And indeed, during this wild chase, Patrick did grow painfully thirsty, but he knew in his heart that he had to keep chasing this demon. So he managed to pick up speed and cut through all the tall grasslands, getting in front of Carathonax to cut her off before she could reach the lake. And when he reached the town of Tullahan in County Leitrim, Patrick feared his thirst might kill him before he finished his mission. He bowed his head and prayed for a drink of cool, clean water, and as the prayer left his parched lips, his horse stumbled upon a sharp rock, and Patrick himself was thrown to the ground. In an answer to his prayer, a well sprang up from where he fell, and he drank the water gratefully. After he drank his fill, Patrick rode on, speeding to catch up to Carathonax and cut her off at Ludaird. When the beast arrived, thinking she had outwitted him, she started to enter the lake, and Patrick then jumped out from behind a large rock. Now, according to legend, some say that Patrick landed on her, and they both sank into the shadowy depths of the lake, locked in fierce combat until he was swallowed whole by her, and he was forced to tear his way out of her using his cross, spilling her blood into the water and giving it its name, the Dark Lake. But some say Patrick did not into the lake. Instead, he stood upon the bank and banished her to the underwater cave with one word, the force of which was so great it lifted Carathonax and slammed her down into the water, creating a wave flooded the surrounding lands for decades. However you slice it, according to this version of the tale, Patrick, the Saint Patrick, was victorious, and the hideous mother of all demons and spitter of toxic fire, Carathonax, has not been seen in the Isle of Arran since that day. But there is another version of this story. Legend has it in this version that Carathonax is not dead, nor is she banished. Carathonax had the foresight to realize that one day a challenger would come. A hero would come to challenge her for her throne of Ireland. She returned to the place of her birth and is waiting. After all, Kenneth Arnack was said to have waited through the ages for the first age of men. And it is said that she waits patiently, covering her strength and amassing a force of demons and monsters, the likes of which our world has not yet seen, awaiting the day when people have forgotten her, so that she can rise and feast on man's suffering once more. According to legend, Kenneth Arnack could never truly be defeated because she was the mother of the most controversial and perhaps the most evil figure within Christianity itself, the mother of the devil himself. But who knows? Maybe she did get cast into that bleak and bottomless lake. By St. Patrick. Maybe along with all the other demons and monsters and serpents, she was permanently cast away. But still, they tell stories of Kenneth Arnack and her confrontation with St. Patrick, and still her legend persists. She exists in songs and tales, even now. So let's talk a little bit about the influence of Kenneth Arnack and this legend with, and her cross-section into the legends of St. Patrick, and how she and St. Patrick coexisted. It's only natural that Kenneth Arnack, being this almost primordial figure representing suffering and blights upon humanity and evil things, that she'd come into direct confrontation with St. Patrick, that she'd come in direct confrontation with the hero of Christianity in Ireland. A controversial and debatable figure in and of himself, he could juxtapose very well with another controversial, indebatable figure such as Kenneth Arnack. But Kenneth Arnack still persists to this day. You listen to a number of bands and storytellers that still talk about this confrontation. For example, the Roaring Kelly Band has a pretty popular song, St. Patrick, the Fire Spitter, and Hawk's Well. Which is basically a retelling of this great legend, but in song. Now, in it, they talk about how St. Patrick chased the mother of the devil, and how she poisoned every well that they passed in their chase, and how they had this dramatic fight that ended with her being cast into the water. And for those of you interested in checking them out, they have their own website, so fully for you. But you can see that Kenneth Arnack still features very prominently in Irish tales and songs. The Roaring Kelly Band, they've done a good job of keeping those things alive. In addition, she even features prominently as a figure in a number of video games, from games such as Judgment Apocalypse, which is a survival simulation game with tactical combat that takes place in the midst of the apocalypse. She appears in World of Warcraft, in the game Judgment. She appears as a chief hellspawn in the game that your character and your cooperative characters, the people you're playing with, I should say. Sorry, kind of scrambled through that. But the people that play the game can team up and take on a number of hellspawns and monsters, as like we'll have it, and she is among them. She also features prominently in games as the Adepts, and these are a lot of role-playing games, as you might have guessed. And she's also in, again, World of Warcraft, there's a whole, let's back up. There is a whole number of people that have found weapons and the like that they have modeled after this character. So Gareth Onak has definitely left her mark, not only on the world of mythology, but serves as a medium and a go-between between a period of time in Ireland where folklore and oral tradition and mythology and rich storytelling saw the changing of the guard. They witnessed the arrival of Christianity. And Gareth Onak represents and really embodies that struggle between the past and the future. She represents that struggle between, conflicting ideologies, the struggle between the archaic and concepts of progress. And interestingly enough, Christians during the early period in which Christianity was getting its spread throughout medieval Europe, they believed that they were a sort of beacon, a changing of the guard. They believed they were going to take people into a golden age. They were pushing people out of what they saw as superstition, what they saw as archaic past. They were trying to pull people into the future as they saw it. They were trying to pull the people around them into what they believed to be the coming kingdom of God. And so to do this, they needed to dispatch these characters. It was critical for early Christians, particularly missionaries, to dispatch pagan ideology and try and find a common ground. And so it should come as no surprise, I should say, that these figures, such as Gareth Onak, feature Christian writings as figures that are antagonists to Christian heroes. And we see this in a number of stories. It's not, Gareth Onak is not the only example in which we see a more pagan character appear in Christian stories. You see this multiple times. There are a number of pagan themes within the Arthurian legends. If you've ever read the Quest for the Holy Grail, all the knights in the Quest for the Holy Grail run into demons. They run into mystical figures such as the Fisher King. They run into who is clearly incredibly pagan. I mean, you look at these characters, you look at the descriptions of these characters. They are very animalistic, very bestial, very tied to nature, and these characters represent that pagan, wild pagan past that Christians are sort of pushing back against. They saw themselves as an ordering force, a force of order and truth, a beacon to lead the masses. And in order to lead the masses, you had to get them away from their old beliefs. You had to change the old guard for the new. And to do that, you had to get rid of these ideas. And oftentimes, the best way to get rid of these ideas was to co-opt them or adapt them to your own way of storytelling so that people could kind of be weaned off these stories. So it's okay if they're kind of there. It will take this figure that we kind of know something about. People know who it is, and then we're going to put them in battle with a Christian, and we're going to have them triumph. And this is a strategy that missionaries used when they went to Ireland, when they went to Norway and Denmark and dealt with the Norse tribes. These are strategies they used to try and break down their message for these people whose culture had been one of polytheism, but also one that relied heavily on symbolism, on metaphors, and oral traditions and storytelling. So they basically just tried to change the programming. If you look at the way that early Christian missionaries attempted to convert people, they often showed up and they would familiarize themselves as best they could with what people believed in the area. They familiarized themselves with the local mythology, with the local folklore. A key example of this we can look at with the missionaries to Norway, Iceland, and Denmark. Perhaps one of the most popular and one of the most well-known gods from the Norse pantheon is Thor, the protector of Midgard, the protector of the realm of men. Thor is seen as almost a Christ-like figure, at least from the outside looking in, although he is rather comedic and very human. This is what makes him so relatable. He is perhaps one of the most popular amongst the Norse pantheon and has been adapted in many different ways by many different storytellers. But interestingly enough, early worshippers of Thor oftentimes crafted and wore necklaces that were in the form of his hammer, Mjolnir. And they would put their hand on this, and they would utter curses. They would utter prayers to Thor for protection, for advice, for guidance, and, for courage and bravery. They would hold this hammer around their neck. They would pray. Well, what did Christians do? What did they hold around their neck? Crucifixes, right? They did the same thing with crucifixes. And the hammer, if you look at it, some of these earlier versions of these, Mjolnir that people are wearing, they look a little bit like crucifixes. And so Christian missionaries attempted to co-opt this. When confronted in some story, there have been a few stories in which missionaries are confronted by Norse, shamans. They say, well, look, I mean, your god's kind of weak, he died or whatever, Odin sacrificed himself, too, and he's kind of, come back and he's smarter and blah, blah, blah. But look at Thor. I mean, he beats up trolls with a hammer. I mean, he's hardcore, he's a beast, he's out there protecting Midgard from trolls and giants and monsters. What did your God do for me? Well, he died for all your sins, and then he came back. These are the arguments that Christian missionaries are making. But in one particular incident, they argued that the crucifix is kind of like a sword. Looks like a sword. Look at that. It's cool. Looks like a sword. And they're attempting to appeal to this culture of heroism and, projections of the warrior lifestyle as being sort of the way to do things, the way of going about things, the path to Valhalla for Vikings, or the heavenly abode of great warriors was death in battle. And you achieved glory in battle on the back of your sword. At the edge of your sword is where you found destiny. Destiny was, you hoped for in your future as a Viking warrior that Valhalla was awaiting, that you were going to be chosen. You were going to be one of the great warriors. So early Vikings kept their hands very close to their swords before they died, right? Because they wanted to make sure they made it to Valhalla. Well,
This fact was not lost on Christian missionaries, and they attempted to co-opt this into their message of Christianity. You know, they basically said, you know, look at Jesus. You know, sure, it's a cross, but it's also, look at it, it's like a sword. And it's cool, and that makes our God stronger. You know, a hammer, and that's just, you know, they're like, that's lame. Why would you want that? You know, swords are awesome. Look at this. It's cooler. It's cooler. So you see that this is one of the many examples of how missionaries attempted to take from the local area, take from the local mythologies, and try and co-opt those ideas, graft those ideas in to their message, and try to sort of undermine the stories that are being told there and adapt them to suit their own purposes. Now, we've gotten through a lot of the material today. So we're going to take one more commercial break, and then when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about hagiographies, a little bit more about the saints' lives. And then we'll wrap things up and give you guys some source material you can go look at. So, again, before I go to break, just want to mention, guys, that if you haven't already, you're going to want to take a look at ChrisBraileyPresents.com. He's got a lot of cool material there. So, catch you guys after the break. We're going to talk about hagiographies, the saints' lives, why they're important. And then we'll wrap things up and give you guys some source material to go look at.
I'm Black Man, saving man's eye, one stereotype at a time.
To the Black Mobile. To the corner of Martin Luther King Street and Malcolm X Boulevard. Pronto.
Will Black Man make it to the crime on time? Or will he be on CPT? Stay tuned at ChrisFraileyPresents.com.
Attention business owners, website owners, event promoters, or anyone looking to promote your product. The Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network is the perfect way to spread the word of your business around the world. That's right, you can advertise at our network and be played on all of our shows at rates that are so cheap, it's a no-brainer. For more information, contact Bay Ragney at bayragney@gmail.com. To keep your business driven, stay driven with Totally Driven Entertainment.
Are you a fan of Sherlock Holmes? Letters from Holmes offers unique, one-of-a-kind letters from the world-famous detective himself. Handwritten on 8.5-inch by 11-inch aged parchment paper and using smudge-free ink to produce original, high-quality letters that fans will treasure for years to come. Each letter is handcrafted and written from the perspective of Sherlock Holmes, mimicking Holmes's native tongue and embracing many of the famous detective's quirks, quips, insults, and peculiarities. Order a love letter, birthday greeting, personal correspondence, or more only at www.etsy.com/shop/lettersfromholmes.
For $5 today, you can buy a wealth of things. Gas for your car, rent a movie for the family, a few slices of pizza. $5 still takes you a long ways. But did you know that $5 can buy your child a bag of heroin in the streets? That's right. For only $5, your son or daughter can buy some of the cheapest and purest dope in the country. Be aware of the lies. Be aware of the stealing. Be aware that's all it takes to kill your child. $5. This message was brought to you by Casey's Cause, a group of parents located in Southern Chester County out to save your child's life. Come join us today at www.caseyscause.com. And remember, $5 is all it takes. Casey's Cause, www.caseyscause.com.
Looking for that perfect gift for your girlfriend? Then look no further than Teddy Scares. Teddy Scares are available in a variety of styles, sizes, and prices for all your shopping needs. Teddy Scares are a mix of cute and creepy to make a great gift for almost any age. Board up your windows, lock your doors, and log on to TeddyScares.com. And be sure to become our friends at Facebook.com/TeddyScares.
Calling all comic book fans. Do you collect comics? Did you ever collect comics? Do you think your children might like reading comic books? Do you even know they still print real, paper, non-digital comic books? Well, then visit the Pirates of Ontario Street Comics in Philadelphia. We have a massive collection of comic books, action figures, trading cards, and much more. We have one of the largest stocks of back-issue comics in the area. We bag and board every new comic book at no extra charge. Our store is voted the best comic book shop in the 2013 PHL 17 Hot List Contest. Part of the movie Unbreakable is filmed in our store. We are open 7 days a week. Ontario Street Comics is located at 2235 East Ontario Street in the Port Richmond section of Philly. Our phone number is 215-288-7338. Type in the words Ontario Comics Philadelphia to check out our wacky stores page on Facebook.
All right, everybody, welcome back. Now, as promised, we're going to talk a little bit about hagiographies, what a hagiography is. As I know I mentioned it, I like to make sure that anytime I mention a term, we define it and we get into it a little bit. You guys better grasp on it. So what is a hagiography, and what is it, why is it important? First off, a hagiography literally translates from Greek to holy writings. It's a biography of a saint. I know I mentioned saints' lives. That's what the hagiographies are. They are saints' lives, but they are not always saints' lives. They're also the lives of ecclesiastical leaders. The term itself may be used to refer to the biography of a saint or highly developed spiritual being in any of the world's spiritual traditions. The Christian hagiographies focus on the lives and notably the miracles of men and women canonized specifically by the Roman Catholic Church, the Anglican Communion, the Eastern Orthodox Church, and the Oriental Orthodox Churches, and the Church of the East. But they're not the only ones who have hagiographies. Other religions such as Buddhism, Hinduism, Islam, Sikhism, and Jainism all create and maintain hagiographical texts concerning saints, gurus, and other individuals believed to be imbued with sacred powers. Now, the hagiographic works, especially those of the Middle Ages, which are were particularly popular, writing for monks and also reading, can incorporate a record of institutional and local history and evidence of popular cults, customs, and traditions. When referring to modern non-ecclesiastical works, the term hagiography is often used as a pejorative reference to biographies and histories whose authors are perceived to be uncritical of or reverential to their subject. One of the reasons why hagiographies have often been seen as sort of problematic forms of source material is that they're relatively biased, right? You're not going to write a saint's life about somebody you don't like. You're not going to write a saint's life about somebody you don't think is a good person. So this makes it a little bit difficult to take things that they say, you know, on face value, because obviously they're going to be extremely biased. They want you to like this person. The whole point of a saint's life, of the hagiographical works, is to immortalize this person as a person worth reading about and as a person to be revered. So if you're writing these stories, you're going to basically only tell the good parts of their life. You're not going to want to say if they ever cheated anybody or did anything bad, because then they can't be a saint. They can't be revered. They got to be perfect, or as near as perfect as you can get. You know, and one of the common themes within hagiographical works is martyrdom. A surefire way to probably end up being a saint is to be martyred. And in almost every hagiographical work, a person in those hagiographical works, particularly in the saints' lives of the Roman Catholic Church, they tend to end with the person dying a martyr's death, sacrificing themselves for the faith or for someone innocent, somebody weaker than themselves. And there's a number of hagiographical works within the Catholic Church. Specifically, they're referred to most oftentimes as the Vita. And there are a number of plays and the like that are based off of these. One of these probably one of the most well-known is the Vita of St. Augustine. But there is also the Vita of St. Christina, which has become pretty well known now. There's a number of Vitas dedicated to all kinds of saints, more saints than you could possibly imagine. There are hundreds of them.
And a number of them have hagiographies. But important to note that not just because somebody wrote a hagiography of your life doesn't mean you're going to become a saint. You still have to go through a process before you can become a saint. There is still a very strenuous and rigorous process to become a saint. And that process is called the process of beatification and canonization. Now, the process of documenting the life and virtues of a holy man or woman cannot begin until 5 years after their death. This waiting period ensures that the person has an enduring reputation for sanctity among the faithful, and it can be waived by the Supreme Pontiff and has been done on two occasions. Pope John III waived 3 years of the waiting period in the case of Mother Teresa of Calcutta, and Pope Benedict XVI waived all 5 years in the case of his predecessor, Pope John Paul II. Now, after 5 years have concluded or earlier, if all or some of the period is waived, the bishop of the diocese in which the individual died can petition the Holy See to allow the initiation of a cause for beatification and canonization. If there's no objection by the Roman dicasteries, in particular the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith, the permission or nil obstat, nothing stands in the way, is communicated to the initiating bishop. Once a cause is begun, the individual is called a servant of God. The servant of God then takes a step forward. They do a part of the process called the informative process, where they do interviews. They conduct research into the person's life, and then you have a congregation for the causes of the saints, where they investigate, you know, the things that the person did. Then they go find out how many people are in support of this. They bless the individual. They beatify them. And then eventually you get to this, go through a number of other steps, which you have to go through and prove that they performed a number of miracles. They have to have performed, you know, multiple miracles to have been in consideration. You know, it's not enough to perform just one miracle. You can't just turn water to wine one time and that's good. Now you've got to perform a number of miracles over the course of your life, and people have to be able to substantiate that you performed those miracles. People got to be able to say that you did them, or have to be willing to say that you did something, you know, good and nice and virtuous. They have to investigate your life and make sure you didn't do anything, you know, cruddy, because you can't have a cruddy saint. And then finally, eventually, after all of these investigations and a couple rounds of, you know, getting support and investigating how many miracles you performed, then they decide to make you a saint. They go through the rite of canonization, and you become a saint. But it's a long process. It can take years. It's taken centuries in some cases for people to be considered saints. Just because there's hagiography written on you, though, so just so you know, doesn't mean you're a saint. It means you can automatically become a saint. In the Middle Ages, it was a little easier. People could just say things happened, and you know that's good enough. Some things for you guys to take a look at. You might want to take a look at Irish History. Came out in 2013, written by Macanide, S. Macanide. Saints by Cause. Here we go. You want to take a look at John Hall Hutchinson, Orthodox Saints of the British Isles. You can also take a look at St. Patrick, Clonmore and Reynolds, from MacNeil Eyne, and the Annals of Ulster, otherwise the Annals of Senate, W.M. Hennessy. That's translated. Take a look at some of the hero stories of Irish mythology. And there's been a number of things done on the snakes in Ireland and all that nonsense. The hubbub, as it were, regarding St. Patrick and casting out snakes. You can also take a look. Here it is. You can also take a look at James Henthorne Todd's The Epistle on Corydicus. It's a translation.
that he did an investigation there. And then E.A. Thompson and G.B. Caird, Henry Chadwick's The Journal of Theological Studies, in which they take a look at St. Patrick and, you know, his life and the controversy surrounding him and his conflict with the old guard. You might also take a look at Peter Brown, The Rise of Western Christendom, Triumph and Diversity. It's always a good idea to take a look at that. John Bagwell Bury, Life of St. Patrick and His Place in History. And then Early Christian Ireland by T.M. Edwards Charles. And then finally, Liam DePower's St. Patrick's World, The Christian Culture of Ireland's Apostolic Age. That's all I've got for you guys today. I hope you guys enjoyed the show. Take a look at that stuff if you're interested in some further reading on the topic. Hope you guys enjoyed yourselves. This has been another edition of Bareback Facts. Of course, you guys will be able to catch me next week. I'll have announcements for the show by the end of the weekend. And, of course, don't forget to catch me 9 a.m. Eastern Time for Straight Football Talk on Sunday. See you guys then. Enjoy the rest of your week.